Welcome, welcome, guys. We are back for another episode of The Lock-In. I'm David Lavin. I am joined, as usual, by my fellow Unibet ambassador and my Bally's roommate for the last few weeks, Dara O'Carney. Dara, we are just back from the World Series. We were meant to record this there, but I think it's fair to say we were both fairly over it in the final days. And to be quite honest, it's only, you know, almost now a week later that I can even summon the energy to pull off a show like this. How are you feeling?
Yeah, I think there was a stark contrast between our last WSOP where we were both going deep a lot and we were really looking forward to bragging to camera. So we actually made a couple of shows out there. I think this time we were like, yeah, no, let's just go back and feel very sorry for ourselves in the room. I'm still very jet lagged, I have to say. I'm only here because I'm pumped full of caffeine at the moment, but this still kind of feels like the middle of the night to me, and I really shouldn't be here. But that said, I mean, you had an even worse trek back from what I gather. Maybe you could tell us about that.
My trip was fucking horrendous. I'm suing Eurowings Discover. By the way, if you're out there, Eurowings, I'm coming after you. It was a nightmare trip. They left us on the tarmac for 7 hours, which is against all aviation laws. And then when we finally took off, obviously missed my connection then in Munich. No information once I got off the plane to whether I could, get on the later flight to Malta or whatever it was. Turns out after all of my own trekking around between terminal buildings in Munich, I was actually put on the flight for the next day. They issued me with a taxi voucher and a hotel voucher to a hotel that was basically in the woods in a town called Friesberg. It was miserable. The restaurant didn't even have food. I was starving. I want to point out as well that I almost got arrested on the plane going from Vegas to Munich because I had the audacity to take out a cereal bar when we were 4 hours on the tarmac and still no food, refreshment or toilet facilities were allowed, at which point the hostess attacked me and said I must sit down because we were on the runway technically and, you know, you're not meant to get out of your seats, at which point I said, you should have been looking after people at this point. You're not meant to leave people on the tarmac this long. She threatened to write me up with a report, said she would deplane me. I said I'd happily be deplaned. She said the cops will come. I said, well, I can't imagine they wouldn't leave me without food and, you know, a toilet facility. So it could be much worse than being stuck on the fucking plane. And then eventually she said, no, they'll be the German police. They'll be the Munich police. They're going to come and get you. She gave me this little report, this like poxy little level 2 warning, which told me that I was going to be arrested when I got off the plane. So I spent the entire plane journey going, I guess I'm being arrested. I'm going to spend a night in German prison. But it turned out it was a bit of a bluff on her part. Maybe one of the few bluffs that got through calling stations such as myself over the few weeks, and she didn't. But I actually called the cops on her. I landed and I thought, well, fuck that. If there's no cops, I'm calling the cops because this was bullshit what they put us through. And anyway, those very nice policemen in Munich said that it was a civil matter between me and the airline and that they weren't exactly going to go arresting the air hostess or the pilot, as was my request. But anyway, I got back eventually 52 hours door to door, you know, as it should be from Las Vegas to Malta.
I mean, I'm surprised, to be honest, that you booked Eurowings because we went Eurowings once before, also via Munich, and we discovered to our horror when we got on the plane that there was no free food, which I didn't think was even legal, that you could fly across the Atlantic and not feed people. And then on the way back, I mean, you went on a different plane, but when I got on, we were sitting on the plane for an hour and then they told us to get off. And they actually told us why. They told us because the plane was overheating. Which was quite alarming to think, well, you know, maybe they might have anticipated this, that the plane might be a little bit hot in Las Vegas. So we got off and I was with the very funny English poker player, Richie Pearson, also known as Ruby. And Ruby was quite adamant he wasn't getting back onto this overheating death box, as he called it. And I remember Googling and finding out that Eurowings at the time had the worst safety record in Europe. So I thought to myself, well, I'll never, ever fly them again. But I mean, I guess when you were looking for flights this year, you found that they were €4 cheaper than the competition.
I knew you were going to say that. I was actually, what was brilliant was that it was a direct flight to Munich and a direct flight Munich to Malta. I could do it in one hop, which is normally a 2-hop journey. So I was thinking more of those lines. But yes, I suppose they were probably a value purchase as well.
I mean, it could also be 0 hops, like Vegas directly into the ocean. So
that's a hop of sorts, or maybe you don't hop, maybe you just plunge. But yeah, look, it was as miserable a journey I've ever done. Actually, you mentioned there how your plane was overheating. We spent 3 hours on the runway before they brought us back, didn't deplane us and told us we were refueling because they didn't have enough fuel because of the fuel they'd used up just taxiing around the runway, which made me worry, like, how much fuel, how like close are they leaving us? Like, how little room for maneuver are they leaving that we had to go back and put more fuel in the plane? But anyway, we did. I won't go any further because actually we've got a fantastic guest who has an even worse story to tell. Misery loves company on this show. We're obviously, it's sort of a World Series recap themed episode. Ahead of this episode, I did pencil down some topics that I thought we should go over. There was actually too many to cover in one show, so we might end up actually talking about the World Series in the next show as well. But joining us this week to help us talk about the topics I have scribbled down for this week is a man who I'm pretty sure Dara is determined to make famous. He is the subject of Dara's hilarious and brilliantly written VSL News article this week. He is an Irish poker player from County Sligo, who has a Sunday Million and a W Coop title to his name. He had quite the adventure, it must be said, on his first ever trip to Vegas just a few weeks ago. He is the always charming Turlough McHugh. Turlough, welcome to the show.
Hey guys, cheers for the introduction.
Delighted to have you on the show, Turlough. Okay, so I know you're dreading being asked about this story, so understandably you want to get it behind you, so I thought, well, the best thing I can do, I can't not bring it up, so the best thing I can do is bring it up immediately and then we'll forget about it after that. So please tell us what happened to you from maybe the point where you got off the plane, got the taxi in and arrived to Bally's and the reception desk a couple of weeks ago.
So I arrived to Bally's after about 30 hours of a little under 30 hours of traveling because my flights were cancelled and I was sent on a run around America. So I arrive in at like midnight in Las Vegas time, dying for the bed. So I handed my passport to the reception, you know, and they're like, sir, you don't have a reservation with us. I'm like, what do you mean I don't have a reservation? Here are my emails. You know, I even paid for it. I paid for a lot of it in advance because I got a non-refundable booking. So they're like, sir, you don't have a reservation. I'm like, here's my confirmation number. They're like, you don't have a reservation with us. It's not there. So like back and forth, I'm contacting booking.com. I'm checking to see if I was scammed by like some random online scam or something like this, because it's very rare that they wouldn't have my reservation. So like 2 hours back and forth at the reception desk, I end up just paying for a night in Bally's, and the guy kind of felt sorry for me. So he upgraded me to a suite. Paid for a standard room and he gave me a suite. So I'm there for the night, get my sleep, wake up the next day, and I call down to see if they have my reservation. They're like, no, sir, we don't have a reservation, but we're investigating it. Which I'm like, well, what am I doing, man? Am I paying for another night or what? And they're like, no, you just stay where you are. You're okay. So at this point, I'm like, they know something, like that I have some sort of reservation. So they leave me in the suite for another night. So I go and play or whatever, and the next day I wake up and I'm feeling sick. This is on the third day, and I messaged Dara to, I thought it was maybe an aircon cold or something like that, and then after a couple hours I messaged Dara, I was like, oh god, this feels more like COVID. So he goes down and gets me the tests and that, and I test positive straight away. So I stay in my room, and the next morning they call me to say, we have your reservation. Somehow they have my reservation and that you can move back to your original room. So I say, you know, I'm after testing positive for COVID. Let me stay here for a while, or I can move, whichever you want. And they're like, no, sir, you stay there. We can't have you moving when you're testing positive for COVID. Stay in your room. You're fine. I was like, I had a fridge full of food, no issues at all. So the next day, next morning at like 9 a.m., security calls me up and they say, you know, sir, you have COVID. You cannot stay in this hotel. And I'm like, what do you mean? And they're like, oh, so I was told I can stay here. And they're like, no, they made a mistake. You can't stay here in this hotel. You have to leave to a quarantine center. So then I'm like, oh my God, I don't want to have to go. And I was like, kind of fact checking to see if this is even legal, what they were doing to me. And the quote unquote transporters were coming at 4 p.m. that day. So, and I was like, I messaged them back. I was like, what if I test negative? And they were like, well, if you test negative, we'll have to deal with that then. And I called them back like 2 hours later and I actually took a test and I did test negative. But they were like, sir, we have a reported case. You have to go to the quarantine facility and that's it. There's no other options. So like, I'm really pissed off. I get pack all my stuff. I've like 2 suitcases, a school bag, and security comes and collects me from the door of the hotel, escorts me out a side door to a waiting like ambulance. And it was only there I kind of really started kicking up a fuss. And I was in the ambulance with all my stuff. I was like saying to the ambulance driver, is this even legal? And I was saying to her, like, do I have to go here? And it was only the ambulance driver told me, it was just like, you don't have to go if you don't want to. We can't force you to go anywhere. And I was just like, I'm on the side of the road. It's like 40 degrees. I was just like, you know, I'll go and try and get tested. So I arrived to this motel, this dingy, dingy motel, like 15 kilometers away, a place called Arizona Charlie's.
So they basically driven you out to the desert, yeah?
Yeah. Like way out. And it was like, I had no choice. There was no test there. It wasn't a choir. I was expecting this clinic. I would walk in through something to test me. Because I was told security is just like, they'll do an official test there for you. It was nothing. It was straight into a motel room. And I was told I'll get 2 meals a day. That was it. And you're not allowed to leave. If you leave, we'll have to report it.
Wow.
The next day then, I get another 2 tests. They bring me down tests from the pharmacy to go and buy them from the pharmacy, these like helpers there at this motel. And I test negative again. And I'm like, oh, fuck, this was I don't know if I'm like cursed here, but I was like, this got to be a false positive test. And so the next day I went to the official clinic. I paid $25 in an Uber. A $95 antigen test, $25 on the way back, tested negative, the official negative test. And so I called Bally's. I was just like, you know, I'm negative. I have the official test. Can you come pick me up? And they're just like, they're almost laughing at me. They're like, sir, we don't pick you up. And,
COVID ambulance goes in one direction.
Yeah. And so I Uber back to Bally's. And so I'm like checking in. I'm like, I'm just done. I'm pretty pissed off, but I'm just happy that I'm negative and get back playing all of that. So I'm checking in and I was like, I'd like to check in. And they're like, oh, what's your reservation? Or I was like, no, I'm in the middle of my reservation. I was kicked out.
I've been here for 4 days.
Yeah. And they're like, oh, so okay, yeah, let me just go and check. So while I'm waiting on this one to go and check, a security guard comes up beside me. He's like, excuse me, sir, what's your name? I'm like, Turlock McHugh. And he said, sir, you will not be allowed to check back into this hotel. God. And I'm like, what do you mean? I have a reservation. You know, I paid for this. So what are you talking about? I've tested negative. You told me this. And they're like, I don't know who told you this, but you're not allowed to check back into this hotel. You can go to any other hotel. At this stage, I am like, I'm just like, I'm broken down. Like I'm almost in tears. Like, and I'm honestly just going to get a flight home. I'm just so pissed off. And
it was also your birthday. I remember because we were
it's your birthday. Yeah. And so the security guy is just like, show me that test. He's just like, I don't know who told you that. And he's just like, I'm just like, what the fuck's going on? You know, I'm starting to kind of rile up a little bit. And he's just like, don't shoot the messenger. I'm just telling you, you're not allowed to check back into this hotel. Go anywhere else. You're not allowed. And I was like, will I be refunded? He's like, no. Your taxes and charges or something like this will be paid back to me. Resort fee, something like this. And then eventually he goes, he's like, show me the test. And he goes back in behind reservation. And there's another security guard waiting there in case I kick up some sort of fuss that they'll fucking drag me out of the place. And eventually he comes back like 20 minutes later and he says, he comes back with a smiling face. He's like, sir, you're allowed to check back into this hotel. So that was my story. It was just a nightmare from start to finish, though, in Vegas.
There was a little kicker, though, I remember, because I think it was that very night you got into your room finally, and then Dara must have got a message from you. Dara, you showed me a video. Do you remember the video you showed me?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it was Turk turning on the taps in his new room, and the water was pretty much jet black coming out. Now I showed that to a few other people too, and they go, well, it was like that in my room too. So
Oh really? Yeah.
Apparently that was luck of the draw. We got lucky. We got one of the clean water rooms. At least it seemed clean. I showed it to my daughter too, and she said, yeah, she had a friend who actually stayed in a hotel in Vegas, and despite the water being that color when it came out of the taps, insisted on drinking the water, which seems like a really bad idea. And then unsurprisingly got sick. I mean, I wouldn't have even drunk the tap water in our room, to be honest. But even less so had it been jet black. No. Also, I think one delightful little detail that Perlak forgot to mention there was that while the place he was brought to clearly was a dingy motel called Arizona Charlie's, they tried to cover that up by, they've given it a wonderful title now, the Liberty Wellness Center, where they bring people who are having their liberty taken away because they've reported unwell.
The Liberty Wellness Center. You really couldn't write it. You couldn't make it up. Okay, moving on. Turlock, I'm so appreciative that you told that story one last time. You can, you know, put it to the back of your mind, hopefully forevermore, unless you also get litigious like me and fancy suing them because, like, fuck these guys. I feel like, well, you know, a losing Vegas could be turned into a winning Vegas in this situation.
I actually was just off the phone to the lawyer 2 days ago, and he told me I have a claim. He said 100% I have a claim. He said, but the size of the claim won't cover his lawyer fees. So he said to contact some lawyer based on contingency. I guess that means like no win, no fee. So yeah, potentially I will. But as you said, I just kind of want to put it to the rear view mirror now at the moment.
Yeah, understandable. Well, look, despite this and despite that story, I, for one, and I think most people at the World Series there, we certainly spoke about this together, believe that the move from the Rio to Bali/Paris is, on the whole, it's better. It's a positive step forward. Dara, right away, we were in agreement that it was a vast improvement. And I suppose, well, first and foremost, the Strip offered a lot more good food options. We went across to the Cosmopolitan most mornings. I know you did this with Turlock one morning as well, to enjoy an egg slut, which became part of our vernacular that week. There was also like dozens of viable food options. We generally ate all our meals in the Gold Coast in Ping Pang Pong before. We were able to kind of mix and match a few different spots this time around, which was nice. But apart from the food, which is obviously all I ever think about, what did you like better about the setup?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I would say I'm not completely convinced that the food was better. There were certainly more choices, but to my mind, like if I was given the choice, if the Gold Coast had still been next door, I still would have ended up, I think, having breakfast in TGI Fridays and the other meals in Ping Pang Pong. But overall, the organization was certainly better. Now, I don't know whether that was just down to the venue, because, I mean, they could have got the organization together in the Rio, but they just never seemed to bother. and also nicer surroundings. Again, it was a little bit weird because Paris was very, very nice, and the room there was extremely well set up. And, you know, it rivaled almost anything in Vegas. But the room in Bally's wasn't great, to be honest. And the air conditioning didn't work there. Now, hopefully it'll work next year, so it will be better. But it is still, it still felt like the poor relation. And the weird thing is that was the main room. That's the room they were breaking into. So, you know, most people would start in Paris, and then as the numbers got dwindled in the tournament, they'd move everybody across to Bally's, which was also another issue because, you know, I mean, they obviously had to move people around the Rio too, but you never had to actually walk through the casino floor with all of your chips. So I think they should possibly rethink that and maybe make Paris the main room, because that's also the bigger room, it's fair to say. And just a final gripe before I wholeheartedly agree that everything else was better. I didn't actually think that the room where they had all the feature tables set up was that impressive at all. It felt like a little bit of a dark back room. For me, it didn't have the same atmosphere as the famous Thunderdome had in the Rio. I'll be curious to see if that came across on the stream coverage. I mean, maybe it looked great on the stream, but I was just reacting to it in person. It just didn't seem that impressive. But all the other things were much better. The organization was better. The standard of dealing, which is never great, still did seem to be a bit better. And at least in Bally's and Paris, you know, when you have a limited time for a food break, there were far more food options. They're using the machines increasingly to register people, and that's helping with the infamously long queues. And you can put money in your card as well to avoid all that stuff. So it feels like they're slowly, after 15 years or whatever I've been going to the World Series, getting some of the fairly basic stuff together. Now maybe it's a fact of how the trip went for us collectively that. At the start, I felt definitely, yeah, this is a big improvement on the Rio. But towards the end, I was starting to see more and more flaws and problems with the venue. It's probably not a fair comparison because our last trip to the Rio was a very successful winning trip, and this one wasn't. So maybe, you know, if we have a winning trip the next time, we might have a better perspective on that.
Indeed, we might. Well, Turlock, I know you can't compare the two. You never played in the Rio, but... were there positives or negatives that you noticed? Anything that you would agree or disagree with Dara on there? And maybe while you're at it, what was your interpretation of the quality of dealers? Because that's always something that gets talked about.
Personally, I didn't have any real issue with the dealers. I had great fun because there were most of them were Chinese, and I speak a little bit of Chinese, so I was chatting to them. I didn't see any big mistakes. I have heard reports of it, but... personally, I didn't. I would agree with Dara on the main stage in the back room that there wasn't a great atmosphere, and it was almost tough to access. I didn't even know where it was for the first week. So, yeah, I didn't know where much was, actually.
Yeah.
Well, changing... Yeah,
you knew your way around the Liberty Wellness Centre, at least.
we're not allowed to bring it up again, Dara. That was... Well, look, changing the subject while we still can, Dara, you wrote another excellent article that I wanted to give a bit of love to on this show as well. You wrote a piece on the rise of women's groups. In the article, you said that more needs to be done to address the major gender imbalance in poker. That's pretty uncontroversial. You pointed to the various online groups that now exist with the purpose of supporting and growing the women's game. You highlighted one group in particular with whom I know you're very familiar, and you applauded their particular way of going about things. Can you tell us more about Herzdamen?
Yeah, Herzdamen is a German group originally founded by a couple of Germans, including Natalie Hoff, who was obviously one of the, well, probably the leading German female player at the moment. And the interesting thing for me looking at ladies poker as it's developed over the last few years is that when I came into poker, it was sort of, you know, ladies were there to participate, and that was sort of the idea. It was you almost got participants medals for turning up for ladies events, and they were sort of presented as big social occasions and not very serious. And the sort of serious business was left to the men. But more and more now, we're seeing more women actually rising up and punching well above their weight relative to the numbers that they are in the poker community. And I think that's reflected in the way a lot of the groups are approaching it now. The groups are no longer just, you know, social groups. Let's all meet up when we get to an event or whatever. There are serious groups now that are doing things like study sessions together. They're getting in coaches. Herzdamen in particular is almost very, very heavily focused on strategy. They have weekly strategy sessions where they bring in guys like Abe Styles or other coaches. I've done a couple of sessions for them as well, one on satellites and one on ICM in the run up to this this WSOP. And you can see it in the results that they're a very small group. I think there's less than 100 in the group in total. And of that 100, I think 18 traveled to the WSOP. And of that 18, three of them actually ended up on the final table of the ladies event, which is a phenomenal rate. And one of them actually won it. So, and they had other results throughout the series too. Another fourth lady was the last woman standing in Colossus. And overall, they had a very successful series. And it was something I think Vanessa Cade commented on too at the time, that a few years ago, when you were walking around the breaks at ladies events, all you heard were bad beats. And, you know, I think we all know that we associate bad beats with pure recreational players. That's generally what recreational players want to talk about. And that as you move up to sort of the more reggae type of people who play, you'll hear almost no bad beat stories. And instead you'll hear people debating strategy. And Vanessa made the point that that's actually the shift that's happening in ladies poker now. You do hear the ladies looking for opinions on strategy or debating strategy, et cetera, et cetera. So even though the numbers aren't growing, I think we're going to see more and more successful ladies because it feels like the approach is changing and sort of the objectives that are being that ladies are set for themselves are changing. I think a lot of that's coming from online because, you know, it's a fairly widely known secret that while women only make up, generally the estimate is 3% of the live poker pool, it's a lot higher online. And the ladies who play online are not there just to take part. They tend to study as well. And as more and more of them sort of summon up the courage and start playing online and start organizing themselves into groups like Hearth's Diamond, I think we will see more and more positive results for females.
Absolutely. Well, I was a little bit worried about you a couple of moments ago, Dara, when you were referring to them punching above their weight. I thought, you might get tongue twisted. We were going to end up in a bit of a scandal where you were referring to women's weight, but you sort of navigated your way out of that sentence very skillfully in the end. So well done on that. You mentioned there the three women who made the finals. Obviously, Natalie Hoff was one of them. She was very unlucky, actually. I think aces against kings and the king came to sort of cost her the chip lead. She would have probably been favored to win the tournament had that held. And then, of course, Jessica Toisel won the ladies event, which was great. I know that group has big plans for the upcoming summer, including the Hearth's Diamond Festival in the Czech Republic. So amazing again to see them actually trying to organize their own festivals and sort of, you know, make a mark in that way. To Turlock, in that piece, Dara finished off by pointing to the comments of Vanessa Kay, the same ones he mentioned there a moment ago. I was conscious that your maybe main connection to women in poker is actually a fellow Sligo person. You're close friends with our great friend and no stranger to this show, of course, Annette O'Carroll. What kind of impression has she made on you down the years? And I know she's a person who likes to dispense wisdom and advice. I'm wondering how influential she's been to you.
Yeah, Annette has been just a great mentor. She's always a very solid figure whenever we're at events or anything like that. And she just always gives me like solid advice, you know, keep it solid. And she has a great saying that she goes to a lot and she says, butter them up and devour them. That's Annette's motto.
Amazing. I love that one. She told me once that you were wasted in poker. She believed that you were due to have an actuarial life or maybe a job of that nature. What does she think these days that you've had a good deal of success now?
She probably still thinks I'm a fish. I don't know. I don't know. We talk a lot. I'm quite pally with Annette, and she's just full of wisdom. And you can't beat experience, and she has a lot of experience in the game.
So we have women's age, we have women's wage earlier on. We're going to move away from this subject now. Next up is Magnus Carlsen. Is he about to choose poker over chess? The world chess champion and, of course, Unibet brand ambassador Magnus Carlsen launched his own podcast this week, muscling in, frankly, on this show. The Magnus Effect dropped its first episode, which sent shockwaves around the chess world, to be perfectly honest, as the Grandmaster announced that he wouldn't defend his chess world title in 2023. During the same episode, he talked a lot about poker. He was just in Vegas. We saw him out there. He played the WSOP main event and he participated in a live stream cash game, which I know featured Phil Ivey. Dara, what do you think of his decision not to defend his title? I know you come from a chess background, so can probably speak with some amount of authority on this. Do you think it's a case of him wanting to maybe pursue at the age of 31 other interests? Or do you think it's more about maybe sort of an insight into how antiquated in some way the draw heavy format, the long sort of the big commitment that championship format adopts for the World Chess Championship?
Yeah, I think, and again, this is since I left the chess world. So I am speaking mostly as an outsider these days. You know, when I was in the chess world, the World Championship was once every 3 years and the world champion prepared for it. And To be honest, the level of preparation back then wasn't that great either, because it was before computers sort of transformed chess. And, you know, you just kind of did your work, and if you were the best player, you won. So Magnus in that era could have just showed up pretty much on minimal preparation and continued to crush. He has absolutely crushed the poker world since he, or the chess world since he hit number one just over 10 years ago. He has the longest unbeaten streak in chess history. And he is like just head and shoulder above his competition. And the guy he was due to play this time was a guy he had comfortably beaten the last time as well. So I feel like he felt that there was just no challenge anymore. But yet at the same time, to prepare for it properly, these days, you know, they surround themselves with a team, and most of that team, a lot of the preparation is done. It's just boring memorization work done with computers and training against a computer, which is kind of the way poker is going too, ironically. But chess is much further along that road. So there's a huge amount of preparation required to be at your best. And it's not particularly interesting work. So I feel like he feels like he has very little to prove now at this stage. I mean, if he beats the guy again, everybody just goes, yeah, well, he beat him last time. So what? We know he's the best. The fact that they do it every 2 years now as well, again, you know, this is kind of this is a bit like the WSOP adding more and more events every year. They're trying to squeeze a little bit extra out of it. So he could potentially be the best chess player in the world for the next 10, 15, 20 years, and every 2 years, and his life will revolve around doing this work every 2 years to defend his title. So I think he's decided to step off and try and do something else. Now, most chess players who try other things don't succeed at them. There are very few people who have been wildly successful in a second field. Some like Jens Schade, you know, very good poker player. But then again, like what wasn't the best in the world either at chess. But like I remember the first time they were doing these sort of hookups between poker and chess, and you were there as well in 2015, and the Isle of Man, they had a Mind Sports Championship, which was a combination of poker and chess. And the thing that surprised me, well, first of all, it was kind of Mickey Mouse, because the chess players just won all the matches against the poker players in chess. Like there were just no contests. And I, as a retired chess player, could also comfortably beat all the chess players, but then I was a punch bag for all the actual chess. I could beat all the poker players, but I was a punch bag for the actual chess players. So there was absolutely no mystery in that at all. You could have predicted every single result and everything went to form. But then the real surprise for me was when we moved over to the poker and just how bad almost all the chess players were at poker. There seemed to be very little correlation across between chess ability and poker ability. Now, I do feel that Magnus is likely to be the one exception to that. First of all, because he's just so good at chess. And he also has proven himself in another strategy area. He's one of the best in the world at fantasy football. So I think he's the kind of guy that when he puts his mind to it, will actually become elite very quickly. Whether he becomes, you know, as elite as he is in chess remains to be seen. But it is going to be interesting. And a lot of the ways the chess players study now are similar to the way the poker players study with computers, etc. He's starting at 31, which a few people have said to me that's too old. Now, I started at 42, and you know, obviously I wouldn't say that I'm one of the best in the world, but I don't think his age will be as big a factor as it would be in, for example, chess. It's fairly well known that pretty much every chess world champion started at age 5 or younger, except I think Bobby Fischer, who might have been a bit older. But that seems to be a thing in chess. I don't think it's necessarily a thing in poker.
Yeah, it did make me think of Michael Jordan. Obviously, when he stepped away from the Chicago Bulls at the height of his power, he gave baseball a go. And you know, people did say that, you know, it was only a few months in when he sort of looked like he was going to leave it. I think he did a full season in the end. But by the end of the season, people said he was getting good. But would he have made the major leagues? Would he have been a top player? Probably unlikely. And as you say, cross disciplines, it's very difficult. Yeah, you do have people like Jen, like you mentioned, who have, and actually Greg, her brother as well, who are superb at both games, but maybe not elite at both games. No disrespect intended. It's a phenomenal achievement to be, hugely profitable poker player, but and also a master of any sense, international master. I think Greg is, and I think Jen is a female grandmaster, a female master. I'm not sure. I do get confused. It's not my world. Apologies if I've got all those titles wrong. But Turlock, I was wondering if I could bring it to you now. You are an online world champion. You have a W Coup title, which I know you insist on being introduced by. That's why I was very clear about doing that earlier. You're probably roughly the same age as Magnus. I'm going to guess. Could you imagine being burnt out and needing to maybe rekindle your love for the game at any point?
I can imagine it, but I've only really been playing for the last 2.5 years professionally, 2 years. So, yeah, I don't feel burnt out. I feel motivated or whatever. So I can't really get into the shoes of being burnt out at the moment.
Yeah, I think that word motivation is the key word, really. And in the article I wrote about this, when I sort of talked about how motivation can ebb and flow, just as maybe ambition can too. Magnus, obviously nothing to prove in the world. Maybe that becomes quite demotivating. Like you said, he was only being confronted with the same person he beat before. It didn't feel like there was a new challenger to his throne. And, you know, he does intend to keep playing chess. In fact, he's got a really packed schedule for the next 2 months in chess. He just doesn't want to play that world championship. And it does remind me a little bit of when Kasparov sort of took himself away from the FIDE system and sort of said, well, I'm just not going to play as part of this system. Dara, you probably remember this better than I do. Mm-hmm. But he essentially didn't want to be part of that sort of, at the time, 3-year circuit. And as such, it sort of deunified or kind of split the chess world in a way. And maybe something like that will happen, because end of the day, whoever wins this one now, nobody will think that Magnus wouldn't have beaten them, and nobody will think Magnus is still not the best. So, you know, chess has lost their poster boy and the person they want to advertise the game with. It's nice for the other two people to have an opportunity to win the world championship, but it's not going to look like the same achievement, is it?
No, absolutely. It won't. I mean, everybody knows he's the best still. And chess, above all other areas of endeavor, has the clearest ranking system, the ELO system, which other sports are now starting to copy, and that makes it clear that Magnus is head and shoulders above everybody else. The idea of a world championship in chess is a little bit weird anyway, because in a sport where it's clear who the best is, you know, what exactly is the point of a world championship? Because if somebody else wins as well, you know, they're still ranked below the other below the world champion. So the chess world is interesting because it has struggled sort of to catch up with the modern times. When I was in chess, it was deeply unfashionable, and, you know, people didn't really give chess much attention. It got a kickstart in the 70s when Bobby Fischer came on the scene, and that sort of made chess cool. But that was kind of product of the Cold War era and the fact that it was America versus Russia. If he had been a random Armenian, I don't think there would have been the same interest. Then chess struggled, at least from a mainstream perspective, from when Fischer left chess to pretty recently, to be honest. And then it got kickstarted again by, you know, the whole interest around mind sports, et cetera, et cetera. And then obviously Queen's Gambit had a huge impact as well on the mainstream. So chess is suddenly very, very cool, but yet it has this stuffy old antiquated aspect to it, as represented by things like the World Championship. And I think Magnus's interest is more in the sort of sexier side of chess, you know, your blitz, bullet chess, et cetera, et cetera, rather than this sort of stuffy old system that he's still lumbered with, and which would consume a lot of his time if he were to sort of wholeheartedly set about defending his title until he's not the best in the world anymore.
Yeah, great points. Dara, I have to ask finally on this, what did you make of him making a big splash in the podcast world now? Obviously, he's put out this the Magnus Effect show, and he's made the splash on his own show, giving his own show the exclusive to get a lot of attention. At Unibet, podcasts are kind of our thing. So, you know, I'm not going to prejudge him here, but, you know, obviously we've got the awards. Don't know if he's going to win any awards, but how did it make you feel that he was muscling in?
Yeah, I mean, we've been actually trying to get Magnus on the chip race for a while. So it does feel a bit of a slap in the face that not only did he not even respond to our request for him to come on the show, but he goes and often makes his own one. But I've always felt that podcasts are sort of like the rising tide raises all ships type of thing. The more people are doing podcasts, the better it is for us in general. I mean, we've commented on this show before that most podcasts don't get past six episodes. So I'll reserve judgment until he makes his seventh episode and see how that goes. But I think podcast is one of those things that everybody thinks is very, very easy to do until they actually try it. And then when they find out how much work it is and they get to episode number five and they're scratching their head trying to think of something to talk about, to the point that they're like dragging random people on who have sob stories from their latest pages. then they find maybe it's not as easy as they thought it was.
I'd like to apologize on behalf of the show, Turl. I'm delighted to have you on. You're a world champion, and it wasn't just because you had one of the more tragic / hilarious stories from the World Series. Yeah. Last but not least, I guess from one Norwegian to another, former Unibet Poker ambassador Espen Jorstad has defeated Australian Adrian Attenborough heads up in the WSOP main event to win a sort of staggering sum of money, $10 million. Mm. It's fair to say that Espen's build-up to the WSOP wasn't ideal. He lost over $1 million in the Terra Luna crypto fiasco. As a result, he was forced to play smaller than I know he would have wanted. For the first 4 weeks of the WSOP, he got pretty much wrecked, only managing a few small caches in quite a few bullets. Then came some run good in the quirkiest of places as he and Patrick Leonard took down the tag team event, defeating Jamie Kerstetter and Corey Paggio heads up. Then came the main event, it was only a few days later, in which Espen got off to a terrible start, bottoming at 17K, I believe, early on day two. I actually saw him at one of the breaks, and he was pretty stoical and also, maybe I'll win some pots and get back into it. Well, he did. A big spin up that day ensued, and he ended the day with 463K, well among the top stacks. There were some ups and downs, of course, but I do follow Espen's Insta story, and it did seem like somewhat plain sailing. He always kind of stayed above 50 bigs and often had a couple of hundred bigs for several days until it came down to that epic 16-hour day seven when he finished joint chip leader with 10 left. Some big holes and a huge flip on day eight put him in the box seat, three-handed with almost 60% of the chips versus Michael Dueck and Adrian Attenborough. Shout out here to John Eames, who is an old pal of Dara's and mine, hasn't grinded the tournament circuit for a long time, but certainly one of the best around when we started. He came fourth for $3 million, an incredible bankroll boost for him. On the final day, Dueck bust to Attenborough fairly quickly, levelling up matters somewhat. But in the end, an outlandish hero call from Attenborough cost him dearly as he ran into the flop trips rivered boat of Espen's Queen Deuce. Turlock, I'm assuming you saw some of this final table. What did you make of it?
I didn't see any of the final table, but I just saw the bust, the last hand.
Yes, well, I do want to talk about that one. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I think I don't know too much. There is a big blind ante in place, so I guess you're looking to VPIP close to, if not 100% on the button.
Yeah, that makes sense. Let me give the hand, just for our audience at home who mightn't be as familiar, I'm going to actually give all the details of the hand, and actually a little bit like our old strategy segments, but we'll do it in this show. We'll do a little breakdown. So the final hand, the effective stack was 233 million. I know Espen had a little bit more. Blinds were 2 million, 4 million with the 4 million ante. So that huge ante in play, like you just said, Turlock, does change things enormously. Espen limped the Queen of Diamonds, Two of Spades, and Attenborough checked back the Jack of Clubs, Four of Spades. The flop came the Deuce, Four, Deuce with two hearts, the Two of Clubs there, and it went check. Minbet 4 million from Espen, raised to 14 million with his four, which I guess he was looking to protect a little bit, Attenborough. A re-raise then, obviously, with the trips from Espen to 32 million and a call from Attenborough, who clearly wanted to sort of test him out, if you like. Couldn't give him credit for a two quite yet. A lot of draws may be possible. Overcard, backdoor, combo stuff could be in there as well. With the pot 76 million on the turn, it comes the eight of spades and it goes check. Espen bets 62 million. And again, Attenborough gets sticky with the call. And on the river with the pot, 200 million. The river comes the queen of clubs, which looks pretty bricky in this situation. Obviously, we know it does make the boat for Espen, which makes his, you know, decision even better, just in case there was any chance he was up against a four deuce or an eight deuce or a king deuce, I guess, is the other possibility. Maybe that might have checked back pre. It's checked to him. He puts it all in, and eventually Attenborough makes the call. So, yeah, go back to that Turlock there. You were looking at the sort of pre-flop play initially.
I'm not too sure, but I guess like because we want to be playing so many hands with the big ante, we can't raise all the hands, so we need to have some sort of a limping strategy, I guess. Mm-hmm. And Queen Deuce off, it seems reasonable. And for the big blind to check behind, I think the big blind can raise Jack four here sometimes, and make it just raise like total junk here, make it like six big blinds or something, but check back is obviously fine too. Check raising the Jack four seems good too. Seems totally fine. You can go two ways. Everything about this hand, you can go two ways. I like the three bet from the Queen Deuce. I would like to call like hands like five deuce, six deuce, three deuce. Because when we board up, the big blind can make a straight. So I like the three bet on the flop from the button. And I think we have to defend with the 4X. All of our fours can defend versus this. On the turn, check call. I think, again, we probably have to defend all of our fours. And on the river, it starts getting dicey, I think. It's a 66% pot bet on the river. And the big blind should defend roughly like, I think he has to fold like 40% of his range. Sorry, he needs to defend. Yeah, he needs to fold 40% of his range on the river to this bet. Does Jack four get in there to that 40% of the fold? It seems pretty marginal. It seems like we have a decent amount of deuce X that will just call the three bet on the flop, check call the turn, and check the river. So we've got a few twos in our hand in the big blind. So the Jack four, I think having a Jack of clubs is pretty good actually, because you do block both Jack two offsuit. If you had the Jack of spades, you only block one of the Jack two offsuits. So it seems reasonable as a hero call for sure.
That's really interesting that you made it sort of that thin. In my mind, it did seem well the other side and probably a foul. Dara, what was your analysis of that hand? Would you agree with Turlock across all the streets, or do you think maybe the river was more clear cut?
Yeah, I would. I'd agree as far as the river. Although to be honest, I think maybe the turn might be a sort of an itty fold as well. It's an interesting spot because, you know, without the big blind ante, there shouldn't really be any limping at this stack depth, but Turlock has made an excellent reason why we have to have limps, because we really can't fold anything getting 5-1 on the button. So we're going to have to limp all over weaker hands, and then we're going to have to balance up some stronger hands as well. So I think the pre-flop analysis is spot on. On the flop, I mean, I think we can probably go two ways as well. We don't necessarily have to check raise this hand. We can just check call and try and exercise pot control / bluff catching. The paired boards are interesting because like we're almost dead against a two. You know, even when we hit two pair on the turn, if he has a two, we're still behind. So I think there's something to be said for sort of just saying, well, if he's a two, we're in really bad shape. And if he doesn't have a two, we're ahead, but maybe he'll keep bluffing. So I think you can make a case, but obviously check raising is fine too. Our four, if it is the best hand right now, is very vulnerable. There are also two hearts on board and there's one open ender and lots of gut shots. So you can make a very strong case for the check raise as well. And we certainly can't give up once we get three bet on the flop, because you know we have the best hand too often. But on the turn, having, you know, he's shown fairly a lot of strength now at this stage. He's three bet the flop and he's fired a big bet on the turn. I think the turn bet was quite big. I think if he'd bet smaller on the turn, we would probably have to hang on maybe with all our 4X. But I think at the size that he used, we could, which was close to pot, I think we could start jettisoning some of our fours. And I think we have enough better hands. We don't necessarily have to call. I also have the words ringing in my ear of a very good cash player in Vegas that I spoke to a lot about during the World Series, who said that if you don't beat any value, just fold. You know, you don't bluff catch in these big in these big spots because most people just don't find enough bluffs. Now, Espen might be an exception to that rule. But I do think that I think the river, to be fairly honest, is fairly clear cut. I don't think the river is ever a call. I mean, we don't feel good about having it got three bet on the flop, so we're already starting to feel a little bit uncomfortable. When he fires again big on the turn, now we should be feeling really, really, really uncomfortable. So I just feel like we're scraping the bottom of our range here. And then when the shove comes on the river, it's I think it's a fairly clear fold, which is why I personally think I would have got out on the turn, because I would have expected the shove to be coming on the river anyway, and I would not be happy calling it off with the Jack Four. I mean, having got to the river, you are in this sort of guess spot. You know you're beating all the bluffs, and you know you're beating absolutely none of the value. Mm-hmm. So it's the ultimate dark tunnel spot. But and I think Attenborough said afterwards that he thought it was a very, very bad call as well. I don't know how much he was affected by the other times he was put in the bin with the river shoves as well. They may have been on his mind as well. Like sometimes when you've made a couple of folds, although he made a hero call, which didn't work earlier as well. Like it seemed like he got all those spots. Well, no, actually he got the first one right, because he did eventually fold after the incredible 21 minute tank.
Yeah.
But you can be a little punch drunk when you keep getting put in those spots, which is why I think it might have been just more prudent not to put yourself in that spot with the Jack Four and just wave the white flag on the turn and accept that, yeah, you're sometimes getting bluffed by the gutters and flush draws.
Yeah, great analysis from both of you there, which I really appreciate. I think, like you said, it seemed very different from the 21-minute tank, this 8-minute tank, till he eventually made the call. This time felt like a more indisciplined moment. It was very obvious he was doing a lot of combination counting in the first one. He was working it out. Actually, the first one was closer, probably, I thought, as well, to being a reasonable call. And he ultimately came down on the decision to fold, which was, you know, in game, the correct one. In this spot, it seemed like he immediately was sort of, as you said, Darren, maybe bothered, maybe a bit punch drunk. And there was like a devil on his shoulder sort of telling him to make the call, even though there was another part of his brain sort of knew it would be a mistake, even if it happened to be right this time. And well, he will, you know, obviously, you know, live to regret that, although an incredible result coming second. It meant that Espen, who, I have to be honest, was motionless. He was like a piece of granite for 21 minutes and then 8 minutes this time. You know, I don't think he could have, you know, noticed a flicker, really. He had his eyes closed behind these sunglasses, and he said he was deep in meditation for both tanks, which probably meant that he didn't quite see the moment when the chips got plonked in at the end, but obviously did get to turn over his queen deuce, and you know, that's the moment he realizes he's champion of the world. Incredible moment. He was interviewed after the match, and he said, "My goal has been to reach the high roller scene and play more 25K tournaments and stuff like that." We knew that from before, and obviously that got curtailed by the Terra Lunacy. "I've dipped my toes," he said, "but now I have a bigger bankroll to take some shots in those tournaments. I need to get in the lab and make sure I'm good enough to play them and make some very sensible investments, cryptocurrencies and tech stocks probably." So I'm not sure he's completely learned his lesson, but maybe, just maybe, he will do it with a greater level of diversification. And obviously from all the people at Unibet and from this show, we wish him very well. He's been a guest on this show many times. He did a strategy segment with us a good while back, and you know, obviously left Unibet a couple of years ago, but we followed his career closely, and he's become quite the high roller beast in recent years. Guys, I'm going to leave it there. On the next show, I promise we will cover the thankfully false alarm shooter story, which caused a stampede in Bally's. Very frightening moment. I know we'd all gone home at this point, right on the last couple of days. We will also talk about Dan Zak winning the WSOP Player of the Year. I want to cover that story as well. There's probably going to be loads more stories because two more weeks will have happened and unfolded. Until next time, thank you very much from me. Turlock, it has been great to have you on. We really appreciate you sharing your tales of woe.
Thanks very much for having me on too.
Delighted to have you, Turlock. And Dara, thank you as always.
Thank you, David. And big thank you to Turlock, because Turlock is a very shy sort, shy retiring player who had a had a nightmare. It's not just his first time in Vegas, but his first time in America. And very nice of him to come on and share his misery with us.
Thanks a million, guys. Take care.
Cheers, guys. Good luck.